supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. Not exactly home to the champion Villanova Wildcats, but right next door. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we'll have lots of tips for first-time gardeners. We'll also welcome our old friend, Dr. Lee Reich, who's going to teach us about how to make our own fruit trees. Isn't that going to be fun? Before that, though, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Maureen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me, and go Nova.
Yeah, thanks for being had and go Nova. Where is Maureen?
I live in Delaware County, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. Did you stay up late and watch the game?
Oh, yes.
Very exciting. All right, so what can we do for Maureen in PA?
Well, Mike, we have had our house for about 6 years now, and we're having trouble with our lawn. It's a corner lot, and it's surrounded by 8 tall white pine trees. We have 5 in the front yard, and our front yard's full shade, and we have 3 in the backyard. Our backyard is partial shade. And the yard is very patchy all over. In the front, it's mostly moss and wispy grass. And in the back, it's grass and weeds and dirt. There's circles that appear in the summer and get bigger of just dead grass. When we dug up our backyard last year to make an organic raised bed for vegetables, there were 1 to 2 grubs per each shovel full of dirt. And we've tried various solutions. We tried Easy Lawn. We tried Weed and Feed. And if new grass starts, it winds up dying before it's mature. So we don't really know what to do.
First of all, the level of grubs you mentioned is actually within the tolerable range. If you look up grub control on the extension websites, matter of fact, years ago, we did a great question of the week that explained how you can identify what type of beetle grub you have in your soil by their hinders. They have very distinctive rear ends. We called it the beetle grub hinder finder. And
okay.
It tells you the tolerable number of beetle grubs per square foot. But I have a feeling, have you been trying to repair the back lawn in the spring?
Yes, spring and fall.
Okay. Well, you're never going to get it to work in the spring. What happens is not only is the soil cold in the spring, not only does summer come on too hot too fast, but the roots of those trees are intercepting all of the nutrients and moisture in the soil. So what you're going to do is essentially nothing, although there is a new product, a new form of BT called BTG. You can only get it from Gardens Alive. And disclaimer, they underwrite the question of the week, but it's also the only place you can get it. And that's something you could put on your lawn now as the lawn is warming up, and that would get rid of the beetle grubs that are in your lawn now. As would beneficial nematodes, which are really cool microscopic creatures that you can water into your lawn as soon as the soil warms up. But what you're going to want to do is plan over the summer to have a nice load of topsoil or compost delivered, spread it out in that backyard area, level it, and then find the most shade-tolerant grass seed you can. You can't just go out and buy fescue or sun and shade mix. You're probably going to need a blend that has a lot of what are called the fine fescues in it. They get by on the least amount of sun. Now, they won't tolerate your kids going at them with a pickaxe, but, you know, they can take a moderate amount of wear. And what I'm going to suggest in the front, it sounds like you've got it already, is just going with moss. You know, we've been talking so much about moss on the show lately, and moss is a really hot topic in the gardening world right now. There's a lot of new books out on it. And some mosses are actually pretty good for foot traffic. So in the areas where you can't grow grass, you could put down very specific kinds of moss that would be green all year, wouldn't need cutting, wouldn't need feeding, and could take a little bit of foot traffic. And, you know, all you'd have to do is arrange things so that it looks deliberate, the different sections. Maybe use a little bit of dividers, edging, something like that to set things off. But out front, tell me that the area isn't covered with pine straw naturally.
No, we rake it up twice a year.
As you move further south, as you move out of the northern states down to the southern states, that is like the mulch. It's almost used as a ground cover, quite honestly. It's very attractive. It's easy to walk on. You can play on it. It prevents the lawn from getting all muddy. And it's there, and it's free, and it's the natural ground cover underneath those kind of pine trees.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good plan.
You can do the moss at any time, but I think if I were you, I would do everything in the fall. Like August 15th to August 30th is the perfect time to get that backyard in shape. I know you want to do it now, but believe me, it's better to plan it and do it right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your help today, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Maureen.
Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Paul, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very, very much. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be on your show.
Well, thank you, Paul. Where are you, sir?
I am in Reading,
Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir.
Secondary mushroom soil capital of the world, home of the Reading Fightin' Phils, one of the best teams in minor league baseball. And home to some of the best pretzel bakeries in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yes, between here and Lititz. Oh, my goodness.
Yep, yep. You are the pretzel capital of the world. I get three different kinds of whole wheat pretzels from the Reading area.
Wow. I think we actually make the Philly pretzels. You have to take second place, I think. I'm not sure. I just adopted about 2 weeks ago my fourth daughter, who is half Rottweiler and half Lab, and she's all black and beautiful and intelligent, but she has raised in my mind a question of some delicate nature.
Go ahead.
So delicate that I can only say that you take the word pup, take out the U, and put in two O's, and that's what I want to talk about.
Right. Sure, sure. No, I mean, we all do it, Paul.
My question is, when I take Lady Lily Langtree out for her walk. That's her name. It was Lily when I adopted her, but I added Lady because she's the mistress of the house, and I do her bidding. So I take her walking, and she does her business.
Right.
And I take along a bag and paper towels, and I bring her business back home with me. Now, you can go to a garden shop and buy, which I've done to try to revitalize an area of the lawn. You know, you can buy fertilizer, which is excrement. And I'm assuming that it's been probably baked or whatever. My question is, can canine excrement be used with some sort of treatment or drying out or whatever? Can it be used as fertilizer? Because I have three children between Baltimore and east and west of me up here that that have gardens and lawns and so forth. You know, or is there some disease or problem or so forth in using that? That's my question.
Right. And it's a very frequent question, Paul. People with companion animals feel bad about throwing this stuff away. But if you want to take the Oscar Wilde look at this, Oscar Wilde once said, there's two kinds of people. There's people who break the world down into two kinds of people and people who don't. There's two kinds of manures.
Okay.
Manure from herbivores, like horses and cows, and then manure from meat-eating animals, from carnivores. And there's a couple of big differences, not only the digestive systems and, of course, what goes in the front end, but also, to some degree, their feet. Cats and dogs have paws, soft paws. So they're very prone, and of course, as you know, dogs will eat anything. So they're very prone to picking up parasites, some of which harm them, some of which don't, but which are often almost always found in their feces. So the feces of dogs and cats needs to be handled carefully and disposed of safely. back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, there was this huge program up in Alaska because they have so many sled dogs and regular dogs, and it's such a wet area. They were trying to find some way to compost the material safely, and I don't think they ever achieved it. So to my mind, the best thing that can be done is it to be put into the human sewer system, because then it'll go through the same treatment and processing than anything else does. I wish there were a better answer about dogs and cats, but there is not. And that's, you know, we were a rescue home for Great Pyrenees. We've always had, you know, an indecisive number of cats living in our house. And, you know, we know better than to try to compost it, and we handle it gingerly.
Well, thank you very, very much for your show and for helping me.
All right. Thank you, Paul. You take care.
Good Lord bless. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear in the Oklahoma City area twice on Earth Day Eve, Thursday, April 21st. I'll give a talk on composting at the University of Central Oklahoma campus at 3 p.m. Thursday afternoon, and then promote pollinators in an evening event for KGOU members at the fabulous Myriad Botanic Gardens. Don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with homemade fruit trees, first-year gardens, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, first-time gardeners are often overwhelmed trying to do everything themselves the first year. We'll offer some hand-holding advice that maybe even experienced gardeners can learn a thing or two from. And we're also going to take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to welcome back our old friend and special guest, Dr. Lee Reich. We're taping this back in late March. Lee's in town for a series of events. Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. Once again, Lee, you may hold the title for most frequent guest on this show.
Good to be here again, Mike.
And you're doing two things today, which is like a couple weeks in the past when people are hearing it. But the first one you mentioned, you're going to be where I always expected to find you, at a prison.
Yeah, I'll be doing a grafting workshop through a horticulture program at the Philadelphia prison.
And I believe there's gardening programs at most of the prisons, but I wouldn't have expected something as interesting and complex as grafting to be a part of it.
Well, I've been to this place before, and you know, they have greenhouses, they have vegetable gardens, they have fruit trees. So, you know, grafting's just another technique that they can use and learn.
Grafting's just another word for nothing left to lose. And later on, you're going to be doing the same thing at the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society.
Correct.
I don't think you and I have ever discussed grafting.
Wow.
On the air. Lee, for those who don't know, is the author of many books on fruit, including Grow Fruit Naturally, Landscaping with Fruit. I actually brought in your old original, which is now called Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, just to have near me. So let's talk about, people hear me talk about grafting in a very general way, in that generally with fruit trees, it's to keep the tree small. You take essentially, and you'll correct all the mistakes I'm about to make, you'll take a green shoot of the tree you wish to reproduce, the fruit you wish to reproduce, and then you'll have a rootstock from a different variety that might not produce the best fruit but has some inherent great characteristic, like it's going to keep the tree small or it's going to be disease resistant. And you put the two of them together, and then you've got the strong root in the ground, and you've got the desired variety up top.
That was almost right. So, first of all, you don't take a green shoot. Usually you do a dormant shoot because you don't want it to have leaves and lose water because it's not going to be connected to a root system for a while. So you use a dormant. That's why this time of year in late winter, early spring is good because the shoots are still dormant. They're not giving off water. They have time to form the graft, and then by the time the graft forms, then they can make new shoots. And there's a lot of reasons to graft on a rootstock. First of all, it's a way to propagate certain plants. You can't propagate, say, apples and pears by cuttings. So the way you propagate them is you find some rootstock.
Now, when you say, I'm going to stop you right there, because we've discussed in the past that you can't propagate an apple tree variety. You can't propagate a specific apple by using the seeds.
Right, because if you use the seed, it represents what pollinated it, and they're not self-pollinating, so something else pollinates it. So basically, if you planted a seed from a good-tasting apple, there's only 1 in 10,000 chance that that fruit that grows from that seed, from the tree of that seed, will taste decent. So basically, the way you have to propagate it is by cloning, and taking cuttings is one method of cloning, but it doesn't work so well for apples.
Yeah, now talk about taking cuttings, because this is how we would propagate a fig tree, right?
We would
just cut off a branch, stick it in the ground, and, you know, because these things grow like weeds, we'd get a new fig tree.
Yeah, so that brings up one of my favorite words, totipotence. And totipotence is the capacity.
She was a children's show host when I was a kid. She used to show Three Stooges.
That's right. I always thought it meant all powerful, not a children's show. But anyway, the concept is that any cell on basically any living thing can grow under the right conditions to make a whole new organism, except for the reproductive cells, the sperm cells and the egg cells. So you could take one cell from a plant, basically, and under the right conditions, which people do, it's called tissue culture, you make them first just multiply, then you make them make roots and shoots, and you have a whole new plant.
But again, not even this is genetic engineering.
Right. This is not genetic
engineering. Tissue culture has been around for decades.
Yeah. And the other way that probably all the listeners are familiar with is another way to practice totipotence is to take cuttings. When you take a cutting, you take a shoot, you stick it in an appropriate medium under appropriate conditions, and then it grows roots at the bottom and makes new shoots and maybe flowers and fruits from its top.
And it'll be similar to the parent plant.
It'll be exactly the same as a parent plant. It's cloning.
And we're talking about figs are probably the easiest example.
Well, figs, a lot of bushes are easier to propagate.
Forsythia.
Forsythia.
Roses, yeah. Even.
Yeah. So there's many, many methods of cloning. Because basically, as I said, all you need is one cell or a few cells or part of a plant under the right conditions. You can make a whole new plant.
But there's some plants that are so complex you've got to do what you're going to be teaching.
Right. So in grafting, you're often using plants, say apple tree, that can't induce it readily to make roots. So what you do is you just take a shoot and you stick it on any old apple rootstock, and then that provides the roots. And then from the graft upwards, it's that clone. So now the thing is, there are other reasons to graft besides as a means to propagate a clone. For instance, certain rootstocks, as you mentioned, they might dwarf a plant. There's certain varieties of apple rootstock that they're just for rootstock. They're not for making fruit.
Indeed, there's a tomato rootstock like that,
right,
where you wouldn't want to eat the tomato, but the rootstock is very resistant to those soil-borne wilts.
Right. And actually, there's apple rootstocks like that, too. There are apple rootstocks that make a tree more tolerant of wet soils, high pH soils, you know, certain soil pathogens. But mostly what rootstocks are used for dwarfing the tree or semi-dwarfing the tree. It doesn't have to be fully dwarfed. And the other thing, the real benefit of apple rootstocks, a lot of them, especially the dwarfing rootstocks, is that they make the tree bare sooner.
Now, where do the rootstocks come from? Are there nurseries that just spend their entire time growing these rootstocks for years from seed? Or someone with your accomplishments, do you grow your own rootstock as well?
So there are nurseries that grow rootstocks, and they don't do it from seed because if you do it from seed, you're not cloning them. So since these rootstocks are special varieties of, say,
right,
apple,
has to dwarf, it has to be this, it has to do that.
So there are ways to propagate, even though apples are hard to root, there are ways to propagate rootstocks.
Okay, so we've got the rootstock, and then generally the people involved have the branch of the desired variety, the dormant branch. Would you call it a scion?
A scion.
Scion.
You can get it from a friend. You can
Toyota
order
doesn't
them.
Make it anymore. Yeah.
You can order them. There's all different ways to get them.
But that's the part that's going to give you, let's say, the apple that you want, the Macintosh or the Fuji. Okay, so here we're back building Aurora models, you know, Superman and the Creature from the Black Lagoon. And we've got the rootstock. And we've got the scion. And, okay, so what are we doing?
So you want to – there's a layer just beneath the bark that's called the cambium. And this is the most active layer. And this is where healing occurs when you cut something. So basically you want to bring the cambium of the rootstock and the cambium of the scion together. And just to put it simply, if you make a long diagonal cut, say about 2 inches long, in a, say, a pencil-thick rootstock, and make a matching cut.
That small?
Yeah. And you make a matching cut on the scion, and then you hold them together. So so the important part is you want the cambiums to be close.
You got a male and a female, kind of.
Well, except two diagonal cuts.
Right.
So they're the same. And then you want to do something to hold them together. So you can, in the past, I used to use rubber bands just to keep it tight. And
that
then,
sounds professional.
and then you want to keep moisture in.
What do real people use, Lee?
Grafting rubbers.
I knew I was going to be sorry.
So, which I do use now.
Practice safe grafting, kids.
And you seal the whole thing to make sure
with wax?
There's a special grafting waxes, or you can use something called parafilm if anybody's in a chemistry lab. It's used in chemistry labs, too.
So now we've got a pretty small plant.
Right.
And we've got all this schmutz around the graft. When the new growth starts coming out of the scion, does that mean that everything is cool or what? How do you know when it's taken?
Well, the new growth could actually begin even if the graft hasn't knit. So you wait till you see strong growth where it's obvious that the scion is not drawing off its own reserves of moisture.
And during this time, the baby plant is in a somewhat protected environment?
No. In nurseries, and I've done it, you just can do it outside even.
Or
you
in the ground already?
Yeah, you can do it. You can have the rootstock in the ground.
But that wouldn't be typical.
No, it's typical.
Yeah?
Or the alternative is what they call bench grafting. You do it inside, then you plant the rootstock out.
Mm-hmm.
And then once growth is really underway, if you used rubber bands, or sometimes people use wax string to hold the pieces together, you got to make sure growth is underway and the graft has knit by then. You take a sharp knife and just slit it lengthwise, just so when it expands, it doesn't get choked. You know, I should point out that there's many, many different methods of grafting, and it's not always with a little rootstock. You can graft, for instance, I'll be doing some grafting at my garden soon on there's some varieties of pear that I have that I decided I didn't like. So the trunks are probably, you know, 2 or 3 inches in diameter. I'll do the Henry IV on them, lock them off, and stick some scions in that cut stub, a different way of joining them.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's nice about that is you have this established root system, and the scions, when they take, they really grow. I mean, I've had like 3 to 5 feet of growth the first season from a graft.
And are you doing one of these crazy, creepy, multiple variety things? Or
I have done that when I run out of things to graft onto, which has happened.
This is a topic that I've needed to learn a lot more about than I know our listeners are really interested in. And I think you've explained it wonderfully. So have fun at your workshops later today. But you give these on a regular basis. You give some at your farm. You give some for PHS. You, like me, you speak all over the country, constantly evading arrest warrants. What's the website where people can keep up with your antics and where you're going to be next?
Okay, if they look on www.leereich.com.
Okay. And once again, we heartily recommend all of Lee's books, The Pruning Book, Grow Fruit Naturally, Landscaping with Fruits, and Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden. Lee, thanks so much for being on You Bet Your Garden yet again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Anne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Anne. How is yourself?
I'm fine.
And where is Anne Fine?
I'm in Haverford, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do for Anne in Haverford?
I've listened to quite a few of your programs over the years, and I know you're not a big mulch fan. Around here, a lot of the stores are selling licorice root, which I've heard is good for azaleas. I'm not able to grow very much in my garden, which is quite shady, but we do have a few azalea bushes. And I'm thinking of going out and buying some licorice root, so if you can give me some advice about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, and thank you for the way you phrased that in the beginning, because I always like to try to make it clear that I am not against mulch. I am a fan of mulch. Mulch was a good friend of mine, but the word has been corrupted. Mulch means anything you put on the surface of the soil to prevent weeds and retain moisture. And it wasn't until, you know, the late 70s, maybe even early 80s, that you started to see this proliferation of wood mulch. And that only happened because landfills stopped accepting wood waste. So instead of going into a landfill, it got chipped up and sold to homeowners. But the way it is used in most American landscapes is totally incorrect. No mulch should ever be deeper than 2 inches. No mulch should ever touch a plant. All of the volcano mulch trees you've seen with these nice blankies covering their root flares, those trees are rotting to death. I'd say slowly, but they're actually dying very quickly. And no mulch of any kind should ever be run directly up to a house, because that creates an underground passageway for subterranean termites to get to the house. There are also some other problems with wood mulches. They tend to breed fungal organisms. I was just at a place where I thought would know better, dropping something off, and they were having their front yard mulch, and the mulch just reeked. There was this terrible sour smell to it, and I thought, oh my God, I'm inhaling aspergillus and all these other terrible fungal spores, and these people are spreading it around their home. So there's a lot of bad mulch out there. Now, licorice root is an interesting product. It's really only available in our area, is my understanding, because the processing plant, the port that the licorice root comes into, is in New Jersey, I believe. And they get the licorice from this root, which is not like a tiny little root. These things are like tree roots. So they're massive amounts of licorice root, but it is basically just wood mulch at the end of the day. And wood mulch is not good for any plant. It can be benign to some plants if it's used correctly, not too close to the plant, not piled too deep. But azaleas and rhododendrons are, as you pointed out, acid-loving plants. And wood mulches are not acidic. They tend, if anything, to be neutral or alkaline. So what your azalea would benefit most from is a mulch of milled peat moss. You know, those giant bales, bricks of compressed peat moss you see at the garden centers.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the natural habitat that azaleas and rhododendrons and blueberries grew up in. So there's nothing better for those plants than an inch of milled peat moss covered with an inch of black compost. That would look fabulous, would keep the soil acidic, would feed your plants, and wouldn't breed any of these fungal organisms. The licorice root may smell cool, but it's just as capable of growing nuisance molds as any other wood mulch.
Okay, that's great. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you, Ann.
All right, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at Green Street Gardens' big Vegemania celebration at their Lothian, Maryland location on Saturday, April 30th, and in Old Town Alexandria on Sunday, May 1st. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with First Year Gardens and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to advice for first-time gardeners who often bite off more than they can chew. We'll explain the things that are essential to do the first year, things you might want to wait a couple of years to try and learn, and everything in between. It's all coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Tony, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, thank you, Tony. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very good. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you for asking. Where is Tony doing good?
New Jersey.
What part?
Cherry Hill area.
Okay, just across the bridge from Philly.
Yep.
All right. What can we do for Tony in the Garden State in Cherry
right.
Hill? I mean, it should be a horticultural wonderland.
It is, but I'm just trying to figure it out now. I've been gardening for 2 years. This is my third year. I started composting last year, and I just happened to stumble upon your program this Saturday for the first time, which I'm glad I discovered. But anyway, the question is, like I said, I've been composting starting last year. Now, at this part, in the beginning of the gardening season, my compost isn't completely broken down. So I'm thinking that I should build another compost bin next to that, stop adding to the one that I have now, but I don't think that it's ready to be added. I'm not sure how long it needs to break down and decompose before it's ready to be added.
What have you put into the first one?
Eggshells, coffee grinds, some yard waste, leaves and things like that, and kitchen waste, you know, vegetable scraps and things like that.
Did you shred the leaves?
I did not shred the leaves, no.
And do the leaves make up at least 3/4 of the compost?
No, I didn't realize you needed that much dry stuff in there.
Well, it's not even so much dry stuff, Tony, is you know, the kitchen waste does not really compost well. I'm sure you've noticed that.
Yeah, some of the stuff just has taken a long time to break down.
Yeah, and you're probably attracting vermin.
Actually, I haven't seen anything, and I was, you know, waiting to see something just because of the nature of the composting, but I haven't seen anything around the area. I mean, it's pretty well boxed in. It's closed on the top and all four sides, so it would be
tough
for something to get in there. But
what's it in?
I made it out of pallet wood, which is, it's heat treated. You know, it doesn't have any chemical process or coating or anything on it.
So. Okay, so you got like 4 or 5 pallets rigged together, and you've got all this stuff inside of it.
Basically, yeah.
First of all, whole leaves take a couple of years to break down, typically.
Oh, wow.
That's why. But you're just starting this. I mean, everybody's first compost is kind of an embarrassment to some degree. You will find this fall that if you shred the leaves before they go in, you'll start making much better compost.
I do have a mulcher, too, so I'll definitely do that this year.
Right. And did you put grass clippings in this?
Very little.
And do you treat your lawn?
No.
Okay. So maybe the compost won't be ready to use this season.
I didn't think that it would be, looking at it.
Yeah. So I'm going to suggest you just go out and buy some compost. It's readily available. There's there's municipalities near you that make and sell or give away bulk compost to residents. And you can buy good bulk compost at some garden centers. What you're going to need to do with the material you have out there is mix it with a lot of shredded leaves this coming fall, because it's probably just kind of stinky. A lot of people start composting because they want to recycle their kitchen waste, but you realize nature doesn't pile up a lot of kitchen waste out in the woods.
Nah.
You know? So with kitchen waste, if you're up for it, the best way to recycle that is through a worm bin. I have a stackable worm bin where you fill up individual trays and put the new material on top, and then the worms have finished at that point the bottom one. They cycle through that kitchen waste really fast. You get beautiful, rich, compost-like material from it, and there's no mess outside. My outdoor compost piles are really just fall leaves with lots of coffee grounds mixed in.
Oh, wow.
And even them, even with the shredded leaves and stuff, a lot of times there's maybe a third of the pile is finished at this time of the year. You know, it takes a while. It's better to be ahead of yourself. But I'll tell you what, you just found the show. So go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org. Right at the top of the page, it says Garden Answers A to Z. Go to C for composting. Give yourself a little tutorial on compost. And there's also an article there that will help you buy the best compost for this season's garden.
Right, right. Okay.
All right, good luck, Tony.
I appreciate the info, and I'm going to go to the website and get some more.
Excellent. Good luck, sir.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Trish, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Hi.
Hi, Trish. How are you?
I'm doing great, even though we're having a very rude cold spell during our spring.
Well, things happen. That's why April is called the cruelest month.
And it is living up to that expectation right now.
Where is nature being cruel to Trish?
I am in Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay. What can we do for Trish in Wilmington?
Mike, I know you can help me with this. I have a huge forsythia bush.
Right.
I've been in this house for many years. The forsythia was here when I purchased the house. And work has taken me back and forth and back and forth. But I certainly remember the days where I had a beautiful golden shrubbery growing beside my driveway. And now that I've been back here consistently, I'm seeing that while I'm seeing beautiful forsythia, golden forsythia in my neighborhood, all I have right now are green leaves and not even very many of those. So what's going on with my forsythia?
I'm astounded. I can't kill mine. I'm serious. When we bought our house, we had three giant clumps of forsythia outside.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to plant some other things. So I had a friend come over, and we started digging up this big shrub. And then we called another friend. Then I had to go buy a case of beer. And by the time we're done, we got like eight guys out there.
Uh-huh.
We look like a road crew. And finally, we drag this thing out of the ground. The root ball must have gone down 4 or 5 foot. And we were mad at it. I mean,
wow.
You know, we had been considering, like, breaking it up and replanting parts of it.
Wow.
But they beat it with shovels, and they kicked it into the woods, which is, like, 15 years ago, where it continues to bloom, laying on its side, roots out in the open, still this day. Have you been pruning your forsythia?
No, I have not. I have never really been a gardener.
Right.
I would say that I am finally, after all these years, paying more attention to my lawn and trying to get things addressed. I do have a bird seed feeder hanging there, and I do know I can see them out there right now. They're little finches or something. They seem to like being in the forsythia because they're feeding from the feeder.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I have birds nesting in my forsythia.
Okay.
Now, you may have come up with something. Do you put sunflower seed in that feeder?
It is a mix, and I suspect there are sunflower seeds in the mix, Mike.
Okay. Well, we'll get back to that. Is it growing in or near a treated lawn?
No, my lawn is not treated. I have it the grass cut, but I've never had any chemical treatments on the lawn.
Is it in an area of dense shade or an area that collects water?
No, it's a very flat, level surface, and at this time of day, I'm getting some nice sun out there.
Okay, so I'm going to suggest that what's happening out there is little known, but very frequent and is the cause of a lot of mysterious plant death in gardens. A lot of people know that the black walnut tree, the roots, and actually all parts of the tree contain a substance called juglone that can inhibit the growth of other plants. It's almost impossible to grow tomatoes within 100 feet of a black walnut. The other, quote, allopathic plant that is almost as strong a plant killer is the seed of the sunflower.
Wow.
Sunflowers, when they drop their seeds in nature, use it to inhibit the growth of some nearby plants. Now, I've never heard of it affecting a forsythia, but that's the only thing I can think of. And you say it's not even very green.
That is correct. It's not very green either.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I would move the feeder or maybe just stop feeding seed for the summer. Birds need water now more than they need bird seed.
Okay.
And then when your neighbor's forsythia are done blooming,
yes,
I would get out there and give yours a really good haircut, a very hard pruning. Take it down to half its size.
Wow. Okay.
And maybe that'll rejuvenate it.
I think this is great, Mike. I can easily take care of that. Move the feeder and give my shrub a real nice haircut when the flowering is over.
That's right. You got a plan.
I can do that.
All right, good luck, Trish.
Mike, thank you so much. Love your show. Great talking to you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Are you a first-time gardener? Remember to breathe. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. Roseanne in Phoenixville, PA writes, I'm really excited about starting my very first vegetable garden. I started some lettuces and planted pepper and tomato seeds in biodegradable pots with organic seed starter. I'm doing a raised bed filled with 50-50 compost and topsoil. Are there any particular bugs to look out for in my area? And what would you recommend to combat them? I know I need to put some type of fencing up to keep out deer and rabbits. Any other tips for a first-timer would be great.
So the first thing I did was email her back and ask, are those peppers and tomatoes under bright lights?
She replied, no, they're in our bay window and seem to be doing okay. I'm attaching a picture of some tomatoes I started about 2 weeks ago. I'll buy new plants if I have to, but there's something exciting about growing your own food organically from seed.
Which forces me to use the phrase that always got me into trouble back in management training classes, yes, but.
Wait, you took management training classes?
Got a D. A class teaching pigs to sing went a lot better. At any rate, yes, there is much satisfaction to be gained from growing food you started from seed, and she can still do that, but maybe not with tomatoes and peppers the very first year. Seed starting is not the easiest skill to master, and I feel strongly that first-year gardeners should concentrate on the things that'll facilitate successful outdoor growing, like having sturdy cages ready for those tomatoes, and building raised beds that are no wider than 4 feet, so you never have to step on their loose soil, and that have 2-foot-wide walking lanes in between them.
So that you don't keep falling into their loose soil.
Exactly. Now, first, let's talk a little bit about seasonality. Some plants only grow well in cool weather, while other plants require hot weather. Her lettuce is a perfect cool weather example, and it's almost always grown directly from seed as opposed to purchased plants. But she has been right to start her first runs inside because the springtime soil is often too cold to germinate the seed. But once those plants have been up and growing for about a week, they should go into the ground outside.
Right. Lettuce loves growing in cool weather and gets bitter in hot weather. So gardeners should concentrate on growing it in the spring and fall.
And the bulk of her lettuce should be sown directly from seeds. Beginning about a month before her last frost date, which is right about now, she can start sowing more lettuce seed directly in the soil outdoors. Same thing as soon as the weather starts cooling down in late August. Fall-sown lettuce sprouts really fast in that warm soil, and it's typically the sweetest and most productive you're going to be able to grow.
Are there other crops she should grow directly from seed as opposed to starting indoors?
Lots. Spinach and other greens in the spring and fall, and sweet corn, string beans, and pole beans as soon as the soil's warm enough in the summer. The really big ones for starting indoors and then moving outside at around 6 weeks of age are tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, and melons.
Speaking of tomatoes, how did her bay window plants look?
Well, you know, at that age, all transplants look pretty much the same. And because of that, I told her that it's still early enough in the game for her to make them garden viable. But it's not going to happen in a window. Young plants require strong light, either keeping the tops of the plants up close to fluorescent or LED tubes, or raising them in an insulated greenhouse.
You always say that sunny windowsill is Latin for sorry your plants look so awful.
And, you know, that ties in directly with our questions about garden pests. The best defense against pest attack is to start out with strong, healthy plants. Tall, weak, leggy plants that grew up light-deprived in a window are going to be magnets for every type of pest. Injurious insects, however, are much less attracted to healthy, stocky plants that had a good early childhood education.
So should she plan on buying replacement plants?
Well, she really needs to be open to that option if her starts are tall and spindly at planting time. But, you know, it's also good that she's trying her hand at seed starting right now, because the only way you learn how to do it well is to make mistakes the first couple of years. Seed starting is something you only get good at by being bad at.
Well, hopefully her raised bed is the right size and she's using good quality compost and topsoil. Should she mix in some perlite or that organic seed starting mix she mentioned to lighten things up?
Absolutely. Now, for the critters she mentions, she can keep rabbits out with a low fence. It only needs to be about a foot and a half high. Then arch some of that fencing over top of the lattice to protect it from the local deer. Then make and use the tomato cages we describe in the A to Z Answers section of our website. They'll give the plants much-needed support, and they keep deer away from the fruits. Well, that sure was some good information about first-year gardening, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots more information about deer, rabbits, raised beds, soil mixes, seed starting, and tomatoes, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to limit my Love Apples lumens if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you're certain that we don't need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location and where you will probably find all the answers to all those questions you were going to email us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our intern, Eileen Kelly, is not only a Villanova girl. She was in the stadium in Houston to see the Wildcats beat the buzzer. I'd say go Nova, but they already did. I think I'll call our webmaster, Rich Banowitz, buzzer from now on. But his faithful assistant will always remain Sarah Kazar, the savage she-devil. Civilized Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Somewhere in the middle is our editor, Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. I stayed up late to watch the whole game, and I'm still tired. So I think I'll take a nap so I can see you again next week. Compost made by local municipalities can be a great resource if you know how to decipher the paperwork that comes with it. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what all those numbers mean to your plants. Plus your fabulous phone calls.